I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome back to Radio Times. In order for couples to remain interested in one another, they require distance, transgression, surprise, and play. We must be able to stand back from our partners to view them as separate, mysterious people for them to remain objects of our desire. That's what our guest psychotherapist Esther Perel writes in her book, Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Intelligence. Her book draws on her work with couples in long-term committed relationships that have lost its erotic spark. She poses some fascinating questions like, can we desire what we already have? Perel writes about the tension between the desire for security and predictability that comes from a committed relationship with the need for adventure and newness and surprise. We invited Esther Perel to share her perspectives on long-term relationships, on marriage, sexuality, affairs, obviously a conversation not appropriate for children. And Esther Perel joins us from New York from her home, and thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. I've had several people come up to me already today to say, what does your guest mean by erotic intelligence? It's the subtitle to your book. Can you answer that for them?
Of course, I will try. You know, it's an interesting concept. Originally, it was much more of a spoof. We had moral intelligence, social intelligence, emotional intelligence, and yet we have always known that they had the ars erotica, the erotic arts, but we've never talked about it in terms of erotic intelligence. And it's a very important distinction between sexuality and eroticism, first of all. Animals have sex. It is the instinct. It is the primordial need. It is our biology. But we are the only ones who have an erotic mind, who can transform sexuality through our imagination, who can have blissful experiences without even touching anyone, just by hinting at it. So it is the experience of cultivating pleasure for its own sake. But more importantly, we, in our erotic aspirations, create a feeling of aliveness, of vibrancy, of vitality, of renewal. And that is the meaning of eroticism way before we attributed a much narrower definition that is sexual, that is today. So when I look at erotic intelligence, I look at how people, not just couples, are able to cultivate aliveness, vibrancy, energy, vitality, how they are able to counter the feeling of deadness that sometimes creeps up in them or in their relationship. And that may include sex. It has very little to do with frequency of sexuality, performance of sexuality. It has to do with how we remain interested, curious, and experience that curiosity from our partner towards us as a person.
Well, in fact, you say in your work with couples, you're not interested in how often they have sex or the kind of sex that they have. You're more interested, as you said, in this notion of aliveness. But it does look like you deal with couples that just don't have that aliveness in their relationship. Do you think marriage or long-term committed relationships is harmful to desire?
Look, for most of history, desire had very little to do with marriage. We married for economic reasons. We married for companionship, economic support, children, social respectability. Then we brought love to marriage. Then we brought sexuality to love. Then we brought happiness down from the heaven, and it no longer is a privilege of the afterlife. It is a mandate that we need to accomplish. And then we linked marital happiness with sexual satisfaction. So we have revolutionized marriage when it comes to sexuality. This is the first time in the history of humankind that we don't just have marital sex for procreation because we want 10 children, and for which we will need to have even more because some of them will not survive. It is the first time in the West where sexuality is not a marital duty of women. And it is all rooted in desire. Mm. It is connected to the individualism of our society in which we own the wanting, that's the definition of desire, and in which we want to have an erotic connection for pleasure and intimacy with a partner just because we feel like it. So how do we sustain desire in long-term relationships is a first. It is not a question that we have asked for most of the history of marriage. And then what happens is that we're trying to reconcile within marriage, to reconcile love and desire, to reconcile intimacy and sexuality. is about bringing together two sets of fundamental human needs, our need for security and safety and predictability, and our equally strong need for passion and novelty and mystery and the unknown. And those two needs actually pull us in different directions and spring from different sources. But we are, for the first time, wanting to experience with the same partner anchor and waves, comfort and edge, security and excitement, predictability and surprise. And we take it for granted that this is a model that should be in the reach of all.
Mm.
And yet it is the grand experiment that we are in at this time.
But it's really asking two different things, as you say, with the sense of love and commitment comes closeness. But you say the desire needs a kind of distance. So it's this very sort of strange, almost like tension or dance between these two, what feel like poles.
Absolutely. You have the word. It's a dance. It's a careful calibration, it's a dialectic, it's not an opposition. But if we would say that love is about having, we could say that desire is about wanting. If love seeks closeness, desire needs a certain emotional and psychological space to thrive. If love wants to close the gap, desire is about opening that gap again and bringing it back to life. And when I ask people, when do you find yourself most drawn to your partner, not just sexually attracted, but drawn to, in the broad sense, worldwide, mating in captivity is translated in 25 languages.
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah.
Been around, and it's extraordinary how the same answers are provided all the time. Number one is when I see my partner passionate about something, in their element, doing something they really like, radiant, playful, confident. It can be on ski, on surf, on stage with the kids, but it is when they are in their element. And I'm looking at my partner from a certain distance, a comfortable distance, not too far because then I can't see them anymore, and not too close because then I can't see them either.
Hmm.
But at a comfortable distance that allows you to see the otherness, the uniqueness of your partner, who after all these years still remains somewhat mysterious, somewhat unknown, a person with whom you can still about whom you can still discover something. So people in their answer are de facto speaking about that need for an emotional distance. Between me and the other lies the erotic elan, lies the ability for the movement of desire that wants to reach out to someone and bring them closer to us or go toward them. And then they talk about surprise, they talk about novelty, they talk about, even when they say, when I see my partner vulnerable, it's because that's the part of their partner that they don't typically see. It's when I get a glimpse at something that isn't available to me on a daily basis. It's when we laugh, when we play, when we are carefree and unselfconscious, which is also on the side of desire. And these various answers imply that if closeness is part of love, desire needs a certain space to thrive. It needs otherness. It needs difference. It needs a bridge to cross with somebody to visit on the other side.
But I think that's so different from the way I think many people believe or feel, which is that if you know someone and they know you so intimately and you feel so safe, then that can be a place for this erotic desire or these erotic fantasies. But you're saying something really different from that.
It is true for many people, what you describe. For many people, love and desire are inseparable and inextricably related. But for others, they are also much more separate. My book started because people would come into my office. I'm a practicing couples therapist for 30 years. I'm actually doing a whole webinar now for this very question. We love each other very much. We have no sex, they would say. I know he loves me dearly. It's been years since I felt wanted. And they knew the difference. Love and desire, they relate, but they also sometimes conflict. To write about people who can't stand each other and don't want to touch each other wouldn't have been particularly interesting. What was interesting is, why is it that so often sex degrades, even in couples who continue to love each other as much as ever? Why does good intimacy not guarantee good sex? Why is the forbidden so erotic? Why is it that when I want and I can't, I want it more than when I want and it almost becomes what I should? So I began to look at what is it in the making of family that sometimes stifles desire, that sometimes the very elements that nurture love, protection, a feeling of responsibility toward the other, feeling of worry toward the well-being of the other, sense of mutuality, reciprocity, that all those elements that are so core to love are sometimes, paradoxically, the very ones that stifle desire, which is much more on the side of the unself-conscious, on the side of carefree. Responsibility and worry are completely anti-aphrodisiac. In the description of when I see my partner radiant, self-sufficient, doing his or her thing, you never have caretaking. It's a very powerful thing. Caretaking is really loving, but it sometimes is very much unerotic. There is something about that freedom of seeing my partner in his or her orbit, you know, without needing me, that allows me to then feel that I want them or that they can want me. It is the real switch between I need you versus I want you that is often at the core of where desire resides.
Well, I think
yes, I don't ask people how much the sex they have because people have had sex for centuries, especially women, and felt nothing. Doing it is really not what this is about. What people want is to experience radiance, to experience love, connection, closeness, intimacy, you know, and that is not in the numbers. That is not something you measure. And therefore, I am very clear that performance, statistics, frequency, you know, is not a model that really reaches to what is more important, which is the quality of the experience and the satisfaction with the experience.
And about a minute before our first break here, I think some people would add to your list of things like kids and laundry, you know, and all the sort of day-to-day responsibilities of family getting in the way of those erotic desires that you were talking about.
But you could say that everything eroticism thrives on, novelty, discontinuity, the unpredictable, the surprise, the playful, the mischief, all of that, if you want, imagination, right, is what family life defends against. Family life like thrives on consistency, on routine, and on repetition, which all three are often sure to kill desire. But, interestingly, as I'm writing my new book now, The State of Affairs, Cheating in the Age of Transparency, I can see how people can think, children, tired, stressed, busy. But you know, the people that I work with now who have affairs are the same people who yesterday were very tired and falling asleep while we were reading the bedtime stories. It also has to do with motivation. And yes, sometimes what you will see with families and children is that actually the erotic energy is alive and well, but it's eros redirected onto the children.
Well, we have to take a very short break. That's the third that you write about, talking with Esther Perel about her book. It came out 8 years ago called Mating in Captivity. We'll be right back.
Happy birthday, America. This Friday, celebrate our 238th year of independence with a Capital Fourth from NPR Music. I'm Corva Coleman with onstage host Tom Bergeron and a huge lineup of talent, including Frankie Valli, Patti LaBelle, Michael McDonald, and more. They'll be performing live from the U.S. Capitol. Don't miss a Capitol Fourth from NPR Music.
Friday night at 8 on WHYY.
Next time in Studio 360, we revisit the first animated character and the first time Tarzan swung through the jungle, and the first mass market blues song.
Ever since Miss Susie Johnson lost her jockey lead.
It's a 1914 time capsule, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You can hear her
tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Compensation guru Ken Feinberg is overseeing the fund for victims of GM's defective ignition switches.
GM basically has said whatever it costs to pay all eligible claims, they will pay it.
We'll speak with Ken Feinberg next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Esther Perel, who's in New York. She's a couples therapist. Wrote a book called Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Intelligence. It's been translated into something like 25 languages since it was first published in 2006. The New York Times, in a cover story, called her the most important game changer on sexuality and relationships since Dr. Ruth. Her critically acclaimed TED Talk reached nearly 5 million viewers, and I believe we have posted that on our Facebook page. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy, to join the conversation, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Esther Perel, I'd like to pick up on what you said right as we were going up to our break there, talking about the third. I mean, I guess children as the third. How does that sort of play out in this dynamic we've been talking about?
Well, I think that what we see often today in families, in our geography, is an erotic energy that has been redirected onto the children. With the children, we are looking for new things all the time. With our partner, same old, same old. The kids are dressed in the latest fashion. We are going around in worn-out pants, and we take off our clothes when we come home. The kids, we are playing with them. We are in an imaginary space with them. With our partners, we often talk about Management Inc. and all the tasks of the running of the family company. And you begin to see that the playfulness, the affection, the physical contact, the tenderness, that whole erotic space is inhabited primarily with the children, and often the couple is left gasping. So one of the challenges is, how do we bring back some of that erotic energy into the relationship? And that's why I talk about erotic energy, not about sex. First, you want a space where you can just be, enjoy each other's company, experience pleasure for its own sake without having to do anything. And from that place, maybe one is in the mood to make love to one's partner and to be made love to. It's not just at 11:30 at night, after I'm done doing all the things on my list, that this is the last thing that will appear. So often, it's not so much the children themselves that sap all the erotic vitality. It's also the adults who don't know how to keep it alive, how to cordon off an erotic space where they say, enough. We're not going to put all the Lego pieces in the box. Nobody's going to congratulate us for that. We're going to now say, now it's our time. We create a boundary around the adult, and it becomes just you and me.
Well, we know of couple. I mean, date night is a sort of common thing that couples do. I mean, maybe they end up talking about the children the whole time. But is that at least an attempt to try to carve out, you know, maybe what it's like to be dating when you're actually in a committed relationship?
Look, I think that dating and date night is two separate things. So on the date night front, I think for some people it's wonderful. For other people, it falls flat. They would be much better if every once in a while they could stay an extra 2 hours in the morning and not only do this when they have a flu and they have a headache, but actually when they say, now I'm going to attend to the quality of my life, because the quality of my life depends on the quality of my relationships. And ultimately, on the long list of what children need, parents who have a healthy sex life should feature as one of those things, because at this point, nothing will keep the family together more than the relative contentment of the two adults that inhabit that relationship. We don't have laws, we don't have church, we don't have social ostracism to keep people together. So it's for the kids. Yeah, I would almost say that the parents need to remain connected, and that means erotically connected as well. So the date night is a good idea for some people, because they're able to cordon off that space and to say, we go out, we get dressed, we go to party, we go to dance, we go to hear music, and we play. That's the idea, is we play. But sometimes they finally go on a date night, and just the idea is, we finally have time to discuss that which we can't get to discuss at home, because at home we have all the noise and the interruptions and all of that. That's not a date night, that's a meeting. Now, I look at lunch sometimes, and I see loads of people talking to each other, animated, engaged, dressed up, and alive. And I ask myself, how many of the people here happen to be with their partner? Very few. Once in a few months even. when people are actually awake and dressed up, and not when they go home with the leftover and they've given the best of themselves anywhere else but to their partner. And it creates a slow degradation. This just, you know, can take years, but it's micro degradations over time where people begin to experience that they are engaged and alive when they are with their friends, and that with their partner there is less and less and less oomph, energy. And from that place to then have sex becomes very difficult.
Well, does that also help explain why people have affairs? And I'm sure there are many reasons, probably a million reasons why someone has an affair, but that's where the energy, the all the things that you have been talking about, that's where that shows up. And whether even having an affair is sort of falling in love with yourself in a way.
That's how Colbert said it to me on the show. He said, so you're saying it's not about I want to be with you, but I want to connect with me.
I saw that,
way
yes.
of putting it that was really a la Colbert. But, you know, there are loads of reasons why people stray. But I think that one of the most important ones, because the majority of people I see are not repeat offenders, they're not philanderers, they are often people who have been faithful for decades, and who one day cross a line that they never thought they would cross. And so one wonders, for a glimmer of what? Why would people risk losing their kids, their family, their house, their money, you know, for what? And women even more so. And then I began to think, to listen to hundreds of people that I see and interview and work with telling me that it is not about sex. That is the big misunderstanding. It is about attention. It is about care. It is about feeling special and important and that we matter again. It is about reconnecting with lost parts of ourselves, and that often when we go elsewhere, it's not just that we want to leave the person that we are with as much as we want to leave who we have ourselves become.
Mm.
And there is longing for that reconnecting with a lost self that is often a part of the experience of an affair. But there's so much to say, you know, about why people go, but it is a piece of this that is often overlooked, that people feel that they are alive. I mean, that is the word that I would say worldwide I am hearing when I interview people about infidelity. People feel alive. They, you know, the same children are there as were there yesterday, but they manage to get energy to cross town and show up at 6 o'clock in the morning on the other side of town, because there is that, I have to have it. I'm energized again. It's that an ultimate experience of eroticism, I would say it like that. And that has very little to do with sex. There may be emotional infidelities, and they will have that same kind of energy of once again feeling important and engaged.
So the idea, I mean, your book is not a list of how-to, but in sort of practical terms is to think of your long-term committed relationship the way you might think of who you might be having an affair with?
Well, it's interesting. I am starting this first online workshop, Love, Sex, and Power, because so many people have said mating in captivity helps me understand the predicament and this paradox between love and desire. And yes, I have said it is not a problem that you solve, but it is a paradox that you manage. And now I want to help you manage this paradox, and I'm going to translate some of these concepts into actionable tools and what to do. I said to a patient of mine recently, whose wife was basically saying, so, you know, he's charming at work, he takes everybody's texts, he answers them within 2 minutes, and then when I write to him, it can take a whole day till he answers me. To which he agreed completely, and by the way, this is not a gender-specific story, but then he begins to tell me, you know, he's totally charming at work. He knows how to cultivate the clients. He knows how to be seductive. He knows how to engage them and how to be interested in them and how to make them feel that they matter and all of that. And I said, and with your wife, you think that in the evening you're just going to come home and you're going to turn around and she's just going to be immediately responsive as if that's the one thing she's been waiting for? I said, foreplay starts at the end of the previous orgasm, you know, and it takes a very different kind of cultivating. That's the erotic. So he says to me, You mean dating? That's what we did when we were... I said, yes, yes. In order to remain interested after 18 years, it takes more of this, not less of this. But you have this notion that maybe now that you are married, you don't have to do what has now become called work anymore. You know, that you should just, when you turn around and you're up for it, that your partner would, you know, magically have thought about the same thing. Yes, it is dating. Dating doesn't stop the day you commit. It takes another name. You can call it romance, you can call it foreplay, you can call it exciting one another, turning each other on. But it is a way of bringing the other person back into, you know, this very erotic space with you. I said, what do you do when you date? You know, you think about fun things to do. You think about shared interest. You think about giving her a compliment. You look at her. When's the last time you look at her? I said the same thing to her. When do you actually just stop and look at each other? And then maybe say something nice that was unsolicited. You know, with lots of appreciation and lots of gratitude and lots of compliments and lots of admiration, those become essential, you know, conditions to then be able to play, to be curious, where you don't just say, how are you? And people answer, how are the kids? Or how are you meant, how were the kids today? But you say, how are you? And you actually mean, no, I'm asking you. I want to know how you are. What's happening to you? What are you thinking about? What are you dreaming about? What do you fancy right now? And most of the time, people will realize that they learn these things when they are in conversation with their friends, in groups. Suddenly they will, oh, you read that book? I didn't know you read that book. Oh, I didn't know you were interested in that. Oh, I didn't know you followed this. It's like, who have you been living with? You know, and it takes willfulness. It takes intentionality. It isn't just spontaneous. Anything that is going to just happen in a long-term relationship already has. You make it happen. But everyone does it when they run a company. They would never run a company the way that they sometimes run their family or their relationship.
I got to jump in here only because I need to reintroduce you, and also I do want to get some callers and some other folks in on our conversation.
Absolutely.
No problem. And that's Esther Perel, and we're talking about a book that she wrote 8 years ago. We normally invite people on their show when they have a brand new book, but it took us 8 years to put this together. We're happy it's happening. The book is called Mating in Captivity, and it's subtitled Unlocking Erotic Intelligence. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. In fact, we have a caller from wanted to know about genders and in terms of desire. Do you, Esther Perel, make a difference, make a differentiation between men and desire and women desire? Are there differences from your perspective?
There are plenty of differences and a lot more similarities. And one could speak an hour just on that. I think that I'm going to emphasize a few things that are maybe less often spoken about. The men have had throughout history the permission to pursue their erotic needs a lot more than women. And women throughout history until today have often put their security needs above their erotic needs. But that doesn't mean that they experience sexuality fundamentally that different of men. What is different is that they are often more willing to forego the whole thing. So it looks that women have less of a need in sex and women are less interested in sex in relationships. And I often think maybe they're not so much less interested in sex, but they're less interested in the sex that they're going to have. Mm. In order to want it, it needs to be worth wanting, and they don't always find that it's going to be worthy enough. It's not a good enough experience. So if I'm tired, I may just as well go to sleep. Now, on the one other hand, I would say female sexuality is a lot more subjective. It is full-bodied, and in that sense, it is much more contextual. She can lose it much sooner, but she actually also can reconnect with it much easier because it is all over her body and much more diffuse and related to her relationship and her feeling about herself. Ask every woman first about her own phylogenia. Would she make love with herself? If she does not like herself, if she does not like her body, if she does not want to stay inside her body, why would she invite anybody to come in there? On the other hand, I think that we often oversimplify male sexuality and think of it as a biological creature that is in perpetual motion, just looking for an outlet. And I think that men, no less than women, are driven internally in terms of their sexuality. Their sense of self-esteem, their sense of depression, their sense of anxiety, their feelings about their accomplishments at work, their fear of rejection, their need for competency, their doubts about her pleasure, all of these are internal experiences that men have that also influence their sexuality.
Let me get Beth to join our conversation. And Beth, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I just have a comment in that I feel this conversation is so amazing. I've been married for 26 years, and 28 years ago when my husband and I were dating, I used to say to him, and I still do to this day, I may want you, but I don't need you. And I always thought that it was my way of telling him, don't take me for granted. You know, I thought it was my own defense mechanism. Hmm. I just had no idea. What everything you're saying is just so incredibly true. I just had to tell you that. It's just amazing. I feel like you're speaking about my life. It's
Thank
just
you.
Very, very cool.
And Beth, it sounds like you're saying you've had a good life. You're having a good life.
I have a wonderful marriage, but it's taken an amazing amount of work. And I've been saying to my husband for many, many years, because we also work together in his practice, you know, you need to invest in this marriage. We need to invest in this marriage like we invest in our finances.
Absolutely.
So you can't expect to retire and have money to live on, and you can't expect to have a marriage if you don't work or if you don't invest in your marriage every single day. And so, you know, or whenever we argue, I say, there's another brick in the wall if we don't deal with this. So this has been, these have all been in my head of, it's just incredible how you make it all so logical.
Well, Beth,
I'm not crazy. This is really working.
I don't think you're crazy. Let me give Esther Perel.
You're very wise.
Let me give Esther Perel. Well, and Beth, thanks for the call to Radio Times, and we're almost up on a break here. But I mean, I'm sure you've heard that before, Esther.
I mean, I think that she's very wise, and of everything she said, and I would emphasize. The grand illusion of love is that, you know, now I have you and we chose each other and I never have to worry about being abandoned and being alone again, and I therefore start to take you for granted in almost the way that we would want to experience a parent. Romantic love lives with an acute awareness that your partner never belongs to you. They are only on loan with an option to renew.
Beth, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We're going to take that short break, get back to our conversation with Esther Perel, and again talking about a book she wrote called Mating in Captivity, subtitled Unlocking Erotic Intelligence. It's been translated into more than 20 languages. We put her TED Talk on our Facebook page. You can give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Whether you're just waking up or you're on your commute, the news is always happening. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Jennifer Lynn. WHYY and NPR's reporters are covering the stories around the block and across the globe that will fuel your day and keep you informed.
So if your alarm is set to 90.9 or were the first preset on your car's radio,
it's radio so vibrant you can almost see it.
And our reporters never take shortcuts.
Morning Edition, weekday mornings on WHYY.
Most of the fish we eat in the U.S. is imported, yet much of the fish we catch here is exported. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Paul Greenberg about this seafood deficit and its implications for our health and the health of our economy and the oceans. Greenberg is the author of American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Drill for oil and find a gusher in your backyard, and in the old days, you're suddenly rich. Find natural gas in the rock below your driveway, and New York State's highest court now says it's okay to ban oil and gas production within the state's borders due to the controversy over fracking in New York. Start spreading the news. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Esther Perel, author of a book that came out a couple of years ago called Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Intelligence. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. What's so interesting to me about both about you and also your theories, your ideas about love and marriage and sexuality is that you're the daughter of Holocaust survivors. Your husband works with torture survivors, but you seem to have been able to sort of glean from their experiences something about being alive, about having desire, about connecting in sort of tense erotic ways in intense erotic ways. And I just love to have you talk just a bit about sort of their influence on the kind of work that you do.
It's very interesting because I know absolutely nothing about my parents' sexual life. It wasn't at all from that place that I began to think about eroticism. But I had a conversation when I was writing Mating in Captivity with my husband, who works in psychosocial trauma and torture and war and disasters, and I kept asking him, when do you know when a person comes back to life? What does it mean to come back from those experiences? And we were talking about when people are once again able to play, because you cannot play if you're vigilant and scared and worried, and if you don't trust, if you're looking for danger all the time, when they're once again able to be creative, when they're once again able to connect with people, to trust people, to open up to people. And that's when I made a connection to my parents' experience. I grew up in Antwerp in Belgium, and it was an entire community of Holocaust survivors. And in my community, I used to remember that there were two groups of people. And it's interesting because I just came back from Belgium yesterday, and I met some childhood friends, and I said, and they looked at me, and I had never said it to them, and they said, that is so true. This was but nobody thought of it in those terms. You know, we just lived like that. There were those who did not die and those who came back to life. And those who did not die were the houses of my friends where you felt morbidity, heaviness, danger, worry. You know, nobody could really laugh out loud. Certainly you could not experience pleasure without feeling guilty because you can only experience pleasure when you feel safe. And those who came back to life, which my parents, I'm very blessed, were part of, were people who understood the erotic as an antidote to death. How to maintain yourself alive in the face of adversity, how to continue to dream, to imagine a better world, to pull yourself from what you're experiencing in the camps, in the concentration camps on a daily basis for years. And that's when I began to think, the couples that I work with that complain about the listlessness of their sex lives, they don't just want more sex. Sometimes they want more, but they always want better. And that better that they're talking about, which could be once a month, it really has nothing to do with how often, is to connect with a quality of aliveness, of vibrancy, of playfulness, of renewal, of intimacy that sex used to afford them or that maybe it could afford them. And it's from that place that I lead the seminars, that I try to say to people, you know what, let's talk about your own erotic self. How do you shut down and how do you keep yourself awake and alive and turned on? But not just turned on in the physiological sense of arousal, but in connected to life, connected to pleasure, connected to experiences, connected to the discovery, exploratory parts of our life.
Let me get, looks like Katie to join our conversation. Hi, Katie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello, Katie.
Hi. I run the Philadelphia branch of a big worldwide company called One Taste, and we teach people about orgasm in order to reconnect them with each other and with their desire. And I wondered if she might comment on some of the best research projects, best homeworks that you've given to clients through the years to reconnect them with desire. So I love everything you're saying. I'd love a little more nuts and bolts.
Well, Katie, did you just say the word homework?
Yes.
Let me find out if Esther Perel believes in homework. Go ahead.
I don't use the word so much because I think it comes with all kinds of associations. So I think more in terms of playing, playfulness, and cultivating the erotic. I like that language because it's actually much more neutral. But one very small one that I will also be practicing with the people who will attend the online workshop is a question that turns the thing upside down. Typically we say, what turns me off is, and what turns me on is. Or you turn me off when, and what turns me on is. And we put it outside of us. And my colleague and friend Gina Ogden once showed me how to turn it around. I ask now, I turn myself off when? Mm. I shut down when? And what you will hear is, or by, when I do emails before going to bed, when I worry about the kids, when I feel fat, when I don't take time for myself, when I don't go to the gym, when it's been years since I went to a movie that I really wanted to see, and on and on. And it is very little about it that is sexual. It really is about people connecting with what I really like to call the erotic self, the self that is open to the world, open to the mysteries of life, open to connect with somebody else and with themselves. Same with I turn myself on. I turn myself on when I go dancing, when I listen to music, when I take a walk in the woods, when I stroke myself, when we have a great conversation. Much of this is not sexual per se either. And from that place, I then can say to people, and now comes the homework. So if you're telling me that you turn yourself on when you go dancing, when's the last time you went dancing? And if you tell me it's been 3 years, and in the meantime you barely remember that your left foot belongs to your same body, then I don't have to give you sexual homework. I'm going to give you dancing homework. I'm going to tell you, go do that thing that you know infuses you with joy and energy. From there, touch and smell and connecting with your own body and with your partners or partner will become a whole different thing. And I'm a big fan of One Taste, and I know Nicole, and I think we are all working to create a more sex-positive culture and a culture where people can experience sexuality that isn't shame and guilt-driven and inhibited and repressed, but that becomes a vital expression of who we are and how we love ourselves and our partner.
And is that why people don't do the things that they love, because of guilt and shame, things like that?
Often, sexually, for sure. Many people sexually do what they think that they can do or that they should do. That doesn't mean that they do what they really would like. Many people do not know how to express their sexual wants or preferences. Many people don't know what to do with their fantasy life, which often feels very disturbing to them or incomprehensible. Why would this turn me on? This is not what I typically, you know, the understanding the erotic mind is understanding that what excites us, and that's part of why desire is, it lives on a separate realm than love, is that in desire, there are a host of wishes, needs, longings that are not always particularly loving in kind. Domination, control, surrender, powerlessness, powerfulness, aggression, needfulness, ruthlessness. All these experiences that are so much a part of hot sex and of desire are often not very loving in nature. That's not what they are about. So there are elements to desire that love kind of doesn't really like to have in its midst.
Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. We have Yuri calling us from Spring Garden. Yuri, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I've been with my wife 20 years, married 17, raised 3 children, went through very, very dark times, happy times in the beginning, raised the 3 children. At times I felt like I was married to my grandmother. Mm. Needless to say, the sensuality, all those things kind of went out the window and were gone for a long time. And recently, my wife and I just somehow, through mutual desire, sat down and said, we need to turn this around. And, you know, we had very frank conversations about, you know, maybe bad things that we did when things were bad in our relationship, put it all on the table, like two adults. We talked about things that would probably have wrecked the marriage under any other circumstance. Then the next day I showed up home. She wore a beautiful outfit that there wasn't much of. And, you know, since then, it's been amazing. It's better than it was when we first met, because now we're so much more mature. And there are no inhibitions. Everything is open.
Wonderful.
And it's just magnificent.
Wonderful.
And you and your wife did this by yourself? You didn't need outside professional help,
if I can
put it that way?
We kind of had problems where, you know, there was some infidelity, and we just decided to have a conversation. Somehow, it wasn't even planned. It just happened, you know? And we both made somehow the conscious decision, without making an agreement to make a decision, to be absolutely frank about everything. And that in itself had a very powerful sexual force to it. I can't explain.
Yes, there is a tremendous amount of erotic charge in a beautiful, intimate, open, honest, all-on-the-table conversation. When do you know that it's life and death? Either we're going to make it, either we are done. And on that life and death, on that perilous edge between fear and fascination, lies the erotic. And so you sit with your wife, and you know that this is it. Either we're going to find each other again, or we're going to be lost to each other forever. And you do it committed and intentional as two adults, as you say, after years of, what did you say? You felt that you were married to your grandmother.
Something like that.
You know, very often I have heard myself say to certain people, particularly in this instance, I would say the primary parent or the mother's, the mother role, it doesn't have to be a woman per se, that, you know, when people say, I have nothing left to give at the end of the day, I am just like maxed out, that often after having been touched and stroked and looked at with this adoring gaze of the little Smurfs and the smiling and the tickling and the nibbling, you know, maybe it's not just that you have nothing left to give, but there is also nothing more you need. And so often the other partner starts to feel that they have become replaced. Because then when they come and they say, I want to connect with you sexually, the wife feels that there's one more child. I already have three. I don't need the fourth one that needs me, as we said. And they begin to confuse offer and demand. Instead of experiencing their partner coming to them and saying, let's maintain the couple, they feel that it's one more person they need to take care of. And that is a very dangerous spiral. So I'm super glad that you guys took your life in your hands and reconnected erotically.
Yuri, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You do, though, write in your book, Esther Perel, about I think the focus for a lot of therapists is that if you fix someone's relationship, then an improved sexual relationship will follow. You say not necessarily.
Indeed. I think that we very often love to think that sexual problems are the result of relationship problems. And therefore, if you fix the relationship, the sex will follow. And it's a wonderful tautology, because then we never have to talk about sex, because if every sexual problem is a relationship problem, all we need to talk about is the relationship. And therefore, we think that sex is a metaphor of the relationship. Tell me what goes on in the living room, and by extension, we'll figure out what happens in the bedroom. But our experience is that many couples improve greatly. Certainly in therapy as well. They laugh more. They don't fight as much. They share the division of labor better. They are more appreciative of each other. And still, it doesn't translate immediately into the bedroom. Because what we seek emotionally isn't necessarily what turns us on sexually. And because what we want in order to make a beautiful family isn't necessarily the place where we can allow ourselves to feel free sexually. And so, but the other end is actually true. If you change something in the sexual dynamic in a couple, it changes the entire relationship. And sexuality then becomes a separate story, its own narrative that tells a story on its own that is not just a reflection of what happens in the kitchen. The rules of the kitchen and the rules of the bedroom are not exactly the same, and 45 million women reading 50 Shades probably should kind of, you know, confirm that by now. But it is we still really hold on to this. My couple said we love each other very much. They have a deep intimacy. They are close and connected. And yet they have a sexual life that is devoid of eroticism or devoid of sex altogether for years.
We're almost out of time here. As you said, you were born in Belgium. You've been living in the United States.
And you know they play each other today.
I totally forgot about that. We should be on opposite sides on this particular issue. But I'm just curious about whether, and you work with couples who are, I'm assuming, largely American. Is there something uniquely American about this tension between desire and love, or do you think it's universal?
So I speak 9 languages. I work in 7, and I work actually quite globally. So I'm very much interested cross-culturally in looking at couples and sexuality. And my teaching and my workshops very much address that. I think that there are a few things that are probably more unique to the United States. This is a society that often thinks about sex as being the risk factor, and therefore it then advises against it as a way to maintain safety. Whereas certainly in Western Europe, sex is not a risk factor. It's being irresponsible that is the risk factor. Mm-hmm. Sex is a natural part of human life and human development, and it's about doing it responsibly. So that's one thing that I think is very important. And the second one I would say is that American pragmatism, get to the point, go straight, don't beat around the bush, goal-oriented, is wonderful for all of what has to do with American economy. It's not always the best ingredients for the erotic economy, which is much more ambiguous, much more lingering, much more patient, much more circuitous.
Well, on that note, Esther Perel, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
And thank you, and you can all find me on estherperel.com.
And the book is called Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Intelligence. And you can go to whyy.org/radiotimes and find out much more about this program as well. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us for today's edition of Radio Times.